sing your songs and dance your dance. I gave your friends all a chance. Putting up with them wasn't worth never having you. Oh, maybe you've been through this before, but it's my first time, so please ignore the next few lines, cause they're directed at you.
What a treat to be in this room, and for the reason that we're here, even though it's kind of tinged with sadness, but we don't want this to be a too sad an event, because it's to be a celebration of an amazing woman and an amazing life. But it's a real honour to be welcoming you all here to this special event to celebrate Stephanie. My name's Jamie Bing. I run Canongate now and joined Canongate in 1992, so a while back now, over almost 25 years since I first walked into their offices on Frederick Street and met this woman who was to change my life, like she changed many people's lives. In her 76 years on this earth, Stephanie Wolfe Murray did many things, and publishing was only one of them. She was a mother to four, a grandmother to, I put 20, but I actually forgot to check with Kim and Rupert. Did you work it out? Oh, 9 or 10, I thought. Anyway, sorry, 9 or 10. And she was a dear friend to countless others, a number of whom are here in this room tonight. One could easily put on an event such as this without even mentioning publishing. Such was the richness of Stephanie's life and the scale of her contribution to other people's lives, not least through the important aid work she did and cared so passionately about and was so committed to. But we are here at the Edinburgh International Book Festival, the board of which she sat on for many years, to focus on her life as a publisher and to celebrate her many achievements in this field. For Stephanie was a truly great publisher, a woman who altered the publishing landscape in Scotland in the second half of the 20th century. Her impact is incalculable because it is still going on. For a start, I would not be standing here, and Canongate would not be thriving if it was not for Stephanie's inspirational mentoring and the foundations she laid. And there is not a Scottish publisher operating today who is not in some ways indebted to Stephanie and her tireless, visionary championing of writers, books, bookshops, libraries, and readers. The format of this event is going to be pretty simple. Well, that's the plan. We have 12 people who will be taking to the stage over the next hour to share with you their memories of Stephanie. Some of these speakers she published, some of them she employed. All of us loved her. First up is her son, Kim Wolfe Murray. Thank you.
I had a lot of different versions of this. My brother Rupert was encouraging me just to fly by the seat of my pants, but I didn't have the courage to do that, so I've written this down. One of my earliest memories as a four-year-old was being given the mighty responsibility of doing the washing up. It was my first real sense of accomplishment. This had been long trailed by Mum as a special treat in store for good behaviour. Now I was finally getting to do the washing up on my little stool, feeling proud as punch. I was Mum's little helper. I don't remember how long it took for the penny to drop. That washing up was actually an irksome chore to be avoided at all costs. But by that time, it was too late. There were four of us, all boys, close in age. I was the eldest. And there was no avoiding being co-opted into the frenzy of morning, evening panic, and evening panics to get to school or get dinner together and, well, forget about homework. For a long time, we commuted from a dilapidated country house in the Borders to school in Edinburgh in a variety of second-hand bangers that Mum would drive into the ground. She was always working late, so after school, I would end up in the Canongate office at 17 Jeffrey Street, circa 1975, packing books in the front window for the grizzled Australian sales manager, Dave Morgan. Thick brown paper wrapping, big rolls of that cardboard, sellotape and proper twine tied tight, but not too tight, according to Dave's exacting instructions. The back rooms were Mum's realms, were Mum's realm. Corridors of books and manuscripts. For a long time, entire print runs would end up as semi-permanent towers squeezed behind doors. There would be a flow of interns, editors, accountants, publishers, authors, and, I shouldn't forget, illustrators, who themselves had become co-opted by Mum as part of the whirlwind carousel that was Canongate Publishing. It wasn't that there was a massive number of books being published each year, but gradually the nest of homegrown authors started to grow into a flock. Foreign titles, histories, really imaginative children's books, even bestsellers. Thank you, Antonia Fraser, Jimmy Boyle, Alistair Gray, for anyone who doesn't know that. Alistair, thank you, for keeping Canongate alive and afloat all these years. So Mum ended up by sheer chance at the center of this Scottish literary revival in the 70s when Edinburgh felt like a cultural desert. However unlikely it seemed that someone from her background with no higher education to speak of, with only a love of books and beauty and wild places, could pull this feat off, that she did. So we're here to celebrate this tonight, and we're going to hear from those who worked closely with her as a publisher and a friend and were affected or influenced by her in some way. I can only say on behalf of my family that we have been quite simply overwhelmed and moved by the tributes and eulogies we have received for so many admirers from every walk of life. We all knew how special, how infuriating, how determined she was. Between ourselves, in our family, we referred to her as the boss. But she was also incredibly loving and kind and forgiving. And I think that's what's going to stay with me into the future.
That was beautiful, Kim. I don't actually know I'm going to get up to the stage every time to introduce people because I could just do it from there, but I probably will do this because why shouldn't I? Flora Fraser, wonderful writer herself, the daughter of the great Antonia Fraser, whose Scottish love poems was one of Canongate's first great successes, is going to come on now and also talk a little about her love of Stephanie. And
I first got to know Stephanie when I was young, and so was she and her. Gus, her husband, and Stephanie were living in a remote glen in Inverness with their young sons. Stephanie, whom Gus called Jell, short for Angel, was luminously beautiful with carved cheekbones and soft brown eyes. But those eyes could snap ferociously when talk around the kitchen table settled on some individual whose character offended Stephanie, or when Kim or Rupert had erred. After Stephanie and Gus moved away from the Glen, another kitchen table at Glenturney near Peebles saw the launch of Canongate. Authors jostled at that table for space with children and manuscripts with interesting foodstuffs. Money was scarce, and it was key, for example, not to drink the Ribena at the sink, which was for visitors only. A book called Food for Free was consulted rigorously, though I still think we were lucky to survive those puffball steaks. Early on, as Kim and and Jamie have mentioned. My mother was called upon by Stephanie to edit a collection of verse to be called Scottish Love Poems. This was a brilliant, creative and business idea of Stephanie's. My mother was then well known for a biography of Mary Queen of Scots, and this was just a great combo. Well, I was lucky enough to be the researcher, which, like him, instead of homework, I went off to libraries and ferreted out candidates, poets, and poems that might work for inclusion. My mother extended the title of Scott to various poets and bards who were, let's say, in exile. Paul McCartney was invited to waive a fee for the honour of seeing his lyrics yesterday appear in this patriotic collection. When he intimated that he was up for inclusion if he was paid £1 million, Stephanie and my mother were absolutely incandescent. Needless to say, yesterday does not appear in Scottish Love Poems. But another Scot in exile, George Gordon, Lord Byron, charged no fee, and therefore his poetry appears. Stephanie saw connections like the one between my mother, Mary Queen of Scots, Scottish Love Poems, nascent nationalism, would just be a great combo. And it was, as Kim mentioned, a great seller. So those connections that Stephanie made as a publisher kept on fizzing. And with her passion and warmth, as Jamie and Kim have said, she attracted a fine editorial team, great illustrators, fabulous authors, young and old, and an ever-growing readership. But the international reputation of Canongate also grew. And perhaps it's appropriate during the Edinburgh Book Festival to remember past festivals when US publishing giant Roger Strauss of Farrar, Strauss and Giroux and other US publishing giants would descend on the North British, now the Balmoral Hotel, and they would hold court at different tables. And like some Celtic Queen Maeve, Stephanie, in holy jersey and dilapidated jeans, and with her mascara not wholly attached to her eyelashes, would waft between them, holding all these great giants in thrall. And I'm quite sure that she secured from each and every one of them a very good deal for Canongate Books in America. Thank you.
Thank you, Flora. Next up, we've got Alan Taylor. Alan, I first met, I think, in Stephanie's office on Frederick Street. I think he was in the process of trying to negotiate an extension to his deadline on a book he was meant to be delivering to her. And but I also know he was a great critic and as a dear friend. So, Alan Taylor, thank you.
I know when I first met Stephanie, I was in a pub in Edinburgh, quite unusual for me, and I was with Bernard McLaverty and Janice Adam, who used to be the head of the Scottish Publishers Association. And I think it was Janice who said there was a party at a place in South Queensferry that we should go to immediately in her car. And this was, I think, Society House. And Stephanie was holding a party for some reason. So we got into the car, we got to Society House. The place was absolutely crowded, stomping, jumping. There was a jazz band playing. There was all manner of things going on that I can't possibly describe. at this time before the watershed. But, as Bernard quickly observed, there was no drink. So we came back immediately to Edinburgh. So that was my first introduction. Of course, the Canongate offices in those days was very near to the Scotsman offices. It was in Jeffrey Street, and the Scotsman offices were on the bridge. But there was a restaurant in Jeffrey Street I can't remember the name of now. Iggs. It's called, Iggs. And that was the only place the Scotsman staff felt they could eat in. So they'd go there, get pie-eyed, and drop in and see Stephanie on the way back. And so I got to know her that way. But I had kind of got her acquaintance before then. When I worked as a reference librarian in George the Fourth Bridge in the Central Library, Alistair Reid popped by one day. And Alistair Reid is a sort of missing person here, really. He walked into the library and he said, I wanted to talk to Alan Taylor. Stephanie Wolfe Murray has recommended me. So I said, OK, I'm Alan Taylor. He said, well, you want to go out for a drink? I said, well, I'm working in the library. He said, yeah, do you want to go out for a drink? So libraries were like that in those days. We went for a drink. We should remember, of course, that Stephanie published Alistair's poems, Weathering, published Whereabouts, his essays. Among the many people she kind of brought to our attention, Alistair was definitely one of them. I seem to recall Alistair and Stephanie had at some point, maybe late on in their lives, at least Alistair had this idea of having some kind of hippie commune in Garlaston, a sort of for OAPs. And I used to kind of raise my eyebrows at this thought. I thought, well, Alistair, Stephanie, hippie commune, yes. Well, Flora's talked about the kind of culinary habits in these places, and I'll return to that in a minute, but I wondered, you know, about food poisoning and things like that. I have a great fondness for the Canongate classics. Back in the day, blessed Walter Cairns, who was the literature director of the Scottish Arts Council, decided with the committee that there should be resuscitated classics, Scottish classics. I did the original research for this. This was to find out what books were out of print and what might be brought back into print. Well, it wasn't difficult. Almost everything was out of print. But what was completely wonderful about it was that although Stephanie has this reputation as batty, she managed to win the contract for that. She managed to get together a board, an advisory board of senior and eminent academics, and to produce books that not only were brilliant books, but were lovely, beautiful, covetable, the kind of books that we hadn't seen in Scotland for a long time. And that's one of the great things about Canongate. Almost all of their books were the kind of books you wanted to have, irrespective of whether you were interested in the subject or not. She had taste, she had style. She also had a kind of strange disregard for money, or a kind of... I remember once going to an event at the National Library in Scotland, and for some reason being driven there by Stephanie. Well... You know, I try not to be driven by people who, you know, have a blatant disregard for the highway code. But she pulled into Chambers Street, found a parking slot, and we got out of the car. And I said, OK, as we moved away, do you not want to lock it? She said, why would I want to do that? She wanted somebody to steal it so she could claim it on insurance. One final thought. I have a really fond memory of a supper at St. Leonard's Bank with Alistair Reid. And I went there for supper. I didn't have that high expectations of the food. I can't remember the kind of first or second courses. I assume there were first and second courses. I remember as we were getting to the dessert, Gus came in through the kitchen window. As we were sitting at the table, said hello to those of us who were sitting around the kitchen table, poured himself a glass of wine, shook hands, drank the glass of wine, and then went back out the kitchen window. Was that kitchen window one floor up or not? I can't remember. Meanwhile, Romanian guitarists and, you know, Costa Rican clowns were coming out of every door and stuff like this. And then I remember Stephanie saying, "Would you like dessert?" Now, I don't think she said that very often. Would you like desserts? Alistair, who himself had no great high expectations of stuff, Alistair was a soup man, you know, lentil soup preferably. Alistair said, "Well, if there's any dessert going, that would be quite nice." I said, "Well, I have some dessert." I said, "What do you have?" She said, "Bananas." "Would you like them baked?" Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alan. Next up is someone who I worked with for a number of years at Canongate, and I can honestly say if he hadn't been at Canongate, Canongate wouldn't have got through what were some difficult periods in the 90s, and he was a great friend as well as a brilliant director of Canongate, and he worked with Stephanie for many years. It's Neville Moyer, so please welcome Neville Moyer.
As Kim has mentioned, the 1970s had seen a revival of independent and publishing in Scotland. To the uninitiated, and that would be me back in 1979, it resembled the Wild West. There were some colourful characters, the buccaneering Paul Harris, the dynamic duo at Mainstream, the wily Norman Wilson, Tyrion Lannister's long-lost Scottish uncle at Ramsay Head Press. There was even a soft pornographer, whilst anarchy was the order of the day at my firm, the student-run Polygon Books. One personality stood out from this crowd, Stephanie. In just a few short years, she had built a reputation that had helped put Scotland back on the publishing map, partly through her publishing flair, but also through Stephanie's role as an ambassador. She cut a widely respected and glamorous figure at book fairs in Frankfurt and America, establishing relationships, working and otherwise, with key figures in the publishing world. For Canongate, before its takeover in 1987 by Fyden Press, it was a case of make, do and mend. Undercapitalised, Canongate couldn't always afford to keep its best authors, unable to match the money on offer from London, or losing authors by not paying royalties on time, Sorley McLean being an example. But then Stephanie didn't always pay herself on time. The smoke-filled office at Jeffrey Street, converted shop premises, was an inviting, if chaotic, place. The toothless curmudgeon, Dave, held forth in the front office, policed by the redoubtable office manager, Sheila McInch, here today. The back of the building was split between Stephanie's office and the bathroom, which featured a bathtub brimful of manuscripts, more a splash pile than a slush pile. Authors, friends, children, godchildren, pets would use the office as a drop-in centre until late into the evening. And Alan Taylor, of course. All were made to feel very welcome. In difficult financial circumstances, having the confidence and the support of the Scottish Arts Council was vital. They placed their trust in Stephanie, first by supporting the Kelpie's children's list, and then by awarding her the Canongate Classic Series, and she repaid them with interest. These series would form the backbone of Stephanie's output for years to come, notwithstanding the dramatic developments just around the corner. Shortly after the classics were launched in 1987, Fyden Press came calling and planted a magic money tree in the Jeffrey Street garden. And I was invited by Stephanie to join the party. Fyden's urbane chairman, George Riches, relieved Stephanie of all the mundane bits of the business, wanting Stephanie to become a creative hothouse. Offices were refurbished, the image makeover was completed by replacing the old wreck of a car she'd bought from an auction, headlamp hanging out of its socket, with a gleaming, brand new sports car. Oh, how she loved that car. And the plan sort of worked. Staff numbers increased, output expanded, we became more ambitious. We published colour books, including Mary Hedwig's Timeless and I in the Hebrides. Charles Palliser's blockbuster novel, The Quincunx, was a huge hit both here and internationally. By 1990, momentum was starting to build. For me, working with Stephanie was a bit like playing Gene Wilder's character in The Producers, constantly amazed as a new world of possibilities opened up, marvelling at the editorial alchemy of Stephanie turning base manuscripts into gold, okay, fool's gold sometimes, but that's publishing. Or how decorative touches or woodcut illustrations might transform a book's design. Or how to throw an epic book launch in the Highlands that would last till dawn. How to bribe the shop steward at a London sorting office to ensure last-minute delivery of thousands of copies of Scottish love poems in time for a big Valentine's Day promotion. How to bamboozle directors at our Oxford board meetings. Late arrivals or mislaid board papers usually did the trick. Until drinks adjournment at noon. And I listened slack-jawed to stories gleefully told of how she had rebuffed the unwanted advances of a misbehaving author or publisher. Being a woman in business back then wasn't easy, but she bore it with a good-natured equanimity. But then luck deserted her. Fiden's parent, the Muslin Group PLC, went into receivership soon after the retirement of its chairman through illness. It was shocking that a business that only the year before had been invited by city investors to take over one of the biggest publishers in London, Century Hutchison, could collapse quite so dramatically. As Musselin went under, so Canongate was cut adrift. Faced with closure or a new start, she showed great bravery and leadership to launch Canongate Mark II. Without a second thought, she remortgaged her house and mustered up enough support from friends and family to get the new business up and running. But 1990 was the start of a recession, trading was tough, and without the scale of investment needed, independence proved to be a continual struggle. Once again, Stephanie used her considerable charm and powers of persuasion to find a new buyer. Once again, a magic money tree appeared. In no time at all, a children's educationalist, an academic imprint, and an audiolist sprouted. But once again, just as things were coming to the boil, the plug was pulled and the owners ran out of cash. There could be no recovery for Stephanie after two devastating business failures. But as I said elsewhere, for Stephanie, running Canongate wasn't an exercise in money-making. It was an artistic endeavour. Her publishing legacy lives on with the list that her protégés, Jamie Bing and Hugh Andrew, bought from receivership back in 1994, and it has flourished in the following two decades and more. As do the core values she instilled in all who work with her, caring for books, paying close attention to their design and editing, nurturing and encouraging authors, being internationalist in outlook whilst championing local talent, and fostering a culture of creative excellence. Well, everyone's got a Stephanie's story about driving, and my favourite story is a metaphor for my time for working with Stephanie. We were due to catch the Frankfurt plane, and I started to get a little twitchy as I could see the flight was due to depart in 45 minutes, and we were still in Jeffrey Street. Finally, she got ready to go. The journey was hair-raising as we raced along Queensferry Road at 70 miles an hour, screeching to a halt outside the departure's entrance 10 minutes before takeoff. She turned to me and said, "You stop the plane while I park the car." It pretty much sums it up. A thrilling edge-of-the-seat ride with Stephanie at the controls, breaking rules, missing deadlines, but one hell of a journey. It was fun while it lasted, and I'm so grateful that she gave me a front row seat for 7 amazing years.
As Neville was speaking, it's lovely watching the people speaking. It's also lovely just gazing at Stephanie as just people are telling, which I'm sure lots of you are doing anyway. If you haven't been doing that, do it. Do whatever you want, actually. Next up is the brilliant Mary Hedwick, who, as Neville mentioned earlier, Iron the Hebrides, I think, was the first book Canongate published with Mary before my time, became a huge success. Highland Journey Follow was another big success. She's known, obviously, for her brilliant Katie Morag books. Here she is. She's the wonderful Mary Hedwick.
Thank you. It's just such a lovely celebration tonight. You just feel the vibe of it all. I first met Stephanie in 1988. I'd reached a kind of crisis point in my life, children grown up, and I did not want to go on doing any more Katie Morag books. And I had a job with the old HIDB in Inverness, of blessed name. And I was in the community co-op movement, which meant going out to all the little islands where the post office was a key enterprise. And also, you know, people were leaving the islands in those days. And I came up with this idea that I would go round all the islands in the Hebrides and record the post offices. Living on call and knowing it for a long time, it was another opportunity to find out about other islands, because there was only one island, the island of Call, but actually there might be other interesting ones. And with contacts through the HIDB, Martin Cummings in the post office in Edinburgh, I approached him first and said, I'd like to do a book. And I'm going to do this as a continuous journey for 6 months. I will live in a camper van and I will go through all the islands and take notes, meet people, do sketches. Now, Stephanie, of course, was the person I met when the post office said, well, possibly Canongate, the publisher at that time, would be interested. So I knocked on that door, met Stephanie, and she was doubtful to begin with, but she came round the corner. I think maybe when the post office put some money into it. The thing is, you know, anything in publishing that's got colour printing in it, this is big money. So it was quite an expensive project I had in mind. But anyway, give her due. She went for it. And I explained what I would do. I would do all these sketches, and then I would come back and do all the final artwork, and it would be this beautiful art book about the Hebrides. And it would, all the text would be in my handwriting, which I quite liked, and that was agreed. So off I went. And it was quite a harrowing journey. It was a big, big thing to do. And I came back after 6 months, went to see Stephanie, and I had my little notebooks, my art books, you know, A5 size, because they would go in the anoraks. Because some of the islands I couldn't take the camper van to. I had to go on foot, so the anorak and the little A5 notebooks. And because there were no art suppliers in the Hebrides then, there would be sketches on one page, side of a page, a sketch on the other, and little notes, and, you know, because I was going to make this beautiful, beautiful finished piece of artwork when I got back. When I arrived at Canongate and said to Stephanie, here you are, but there's no way I'm going to sit down and do final artwork. I'm absolutely burnt out. And give her due, she said, I think we'll make a go of it. And she was the one who said, forget about the handwriting, because I was trying to do that Edwardian lady sketchbook of that time. You're talking late 80s. And she said, no, we'll have text, and that will, you know, complement better your artwork. And that was the person who actually gave me my first chance to get into grown-up writing. And that book is now coming up to 40 years old, and it's still in print. And it was thanks to her kind of, you know, I don't know, bravery in a way that she took it on. But subsequent to that, we became personal friends. And we shared so much. All our worries about our children and our grandchildren and our love of remote places. She would come and visit Call, and she would step off the McBrain boat down the gangplank, looking as though she was arriving on a Greek island. This beautiful woman with the dark hair, the white shirt, and the nice little sort of, you know, I don't know what they were called in those days, but little short trousers. And this is something we shared so much, our love of remote places. And I often travelled with her. And I think this side is a bit personal, but, you know, we did enjoy each other's company and had that, I don't know, intimacy with each other. Last summer, I live near Inverness now, and she came to stay because we were going to Belladrum Book Festival, where Rupert's book was being launched. And she was tired, I knew that. And that was, you know, a year ago from now. But we were enjoying being two old ladies at this sort of, you know, amazing rock festival, you know. And she came back and enjoyed my cats and all that. And then in March of this year, I went to see her down at Glenlude. And, of course, the news was out that she had the illness. And she was just so strong and positive and hopeful for this, whatever they do. And I was sleeping in the conservatory, which was, I think, in the old days at Glenlude, would have been a conservatory. But it was a lovely lounge and sitting room and couches and everything. And the bed for the visitor was in amongst all the potted plants and everything. And that night I struggled with this. It was a geranium, a trailing geranium that was over the bed. And I kept on whipping it away, you know. I woke up and in the morning I did a terrible thing. I actually took two cuttings from that invading plant, and then it was time for breakfast, and as ever, a house full of people, and it was time for me to travel north again. And I didn't tell her that I had pinched two cuttings, at least two, from this plant. And I often think about that now. Why did I not say anything? And in a funny kind of way, she was being so brave, I thought I must not take anything else away from her. And I now have these little cuttings and they're growing really high. Thank you.
I know Stephanie would be so happy you took those cuttings, Mary. Next up is another great author that Canongate published and Stephanie was responsible for bringing to Canongate, and it's the wonderful Alistair Gray, whose first novel, Lanark, was the first of many great books that Canongate published and many great books that he wrote, not all published by Canongate. He also, as you know, is an incredible artist and illustrator too, and we are so lucky to have Alistair here today. So welcome, Alistair.
We got on well very early. The point is that I had written this very ambitious novel, which had started in my late teens. I meant it to be a Scottish epic, and as such, in fact, it began as two novels that were being written simultaneously. One, a kind of Kafkaesque science fiction novel, another, Glaswegian portrait of the artist as a young man. That is, had been influenced by both Kafka and James Joyce and wanted to do something like them, but in Scotland. And then at a certain point, I decided that these two books should be one. And anyway, I got a very good literary agent in London, and she showed it to three or four London publishers who were all interested, except the length. What they said was that to print such a very, very long book by an unknown author would be a risk. But if I would split it into two, they would sign a contract for both of them. And I said no, because I wanted it to be one book, and I knew if they were done separately, they would never be joined together again. However, one of the publisher's quartet books, give an advance of £90 for the rights of first refusal. And £90 in that period was the equivalent, I think it might be of probably 1,000 nowadays. I'm talking about the 70s. Anyway, actually, I got the first chapter of it published in a magazine, Scottish International, which was a very good literary magazine. Scotland hasn't had one as good as that. It lasted for a couple of years. Bob Tate was the editor, and it actually published the first two or three chapters. And then I got a phone call from Angus Wolfe Murray, who said that when he finished it, that Lanark would, the Canongate would like to publish it. I said, sorry, you know, London publisher has got the first rights of and that was that. And eventually when I did finish the novel, and Quartet Books turned it down on the same terms, it was too long a book, it would be risky, would I split it into two? So I said no, and felt depressed. Anyway, eventually I sent it to Canongate, thinking a Scottish publisher, you know. Scotland had been the centre of the British publishing industry in the early 19th century, partly due to Walter Scott, but not just that, you know. The Sorry, I'm just remembering that Gibbon in his autobiography mentions that when he started bringing out The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, he got a letter from Adam Smith saying that we in Edinburgh in Scotland are amazed that an Englishman is capable of such an impressive work. we think that England is so obsessed with the idiocies of party politics that they're incapable of producing an original intellectual work. Gibbons was obviously rather appreciated because he quoted this letter at considerable length. Oh yes, and another thing that he mentioned in his autobiography, it's a bit, I forget, yes, he went to Oxford, but he was saying sort of there has been considerable contention between Oxford and Cambridge as to which is the older establishment. And said, whatever it is, there can be no doubt that that both institutions were giving signs of advanced senility. well, every institution has ups and downs. The thing is that when eventually Charles Wilde, who was Stephanie's partner then, wrote to say that they were prepared to take Canongate on and that it would be a bit of a risk, but they felt they would get a guarantee from the Scottish Arts Council. And when I met Stephanie, we discussed it, and I won't go into all the details, but she accepted all my suggestions, some of which seemed to be novelties about the layout of the book. And I explained to her that I had no intention of writing more than one novel. There would, however, be a book of short stories, some of which were finished. And then there would be a book of poems, a book of plays, and a book of essays, each perfect of its kind, and a book of reproductions of paintings. And it's good, yes, that's fine, to all of them. And we signed a contract for the book of short stories, unlikely stories mostly. And, well, I can't exactly say unluckily. One of the short stories was going to be a likely story. I thought it would be just a few pages, but well, when I got down to work on it, it started to swell up. In fact, it turned into a second novel, one which I think much better than Lanark. It's about a third of the length, and the centre and well, anyway, the point is that while I was writing it, I was at a job as writer in residence at Glasgow University. And plenty of time and steady money. That job ended, and I'd asked Stephanie Splinter, the book of short stories was coming out. I said, could you give me an advance of £1,000 so that I can finish this novel? And she said, no, but. She would show it to American publishers, and they might pay the advance, and it would be passed on to me. However, the American publisher said, "Certainly not," so I stopped working on it, eventually, I was advised that Liz Calder of Jonathan Cape suggested I send it to her, so I did, and I asked for £1,000 advance, and I got it. I did not leave Canongate. There was an article, not a newspaper thing. Not authorised by Stephanie, which was suggesting that as soon as a small Scottish publisher had made me well known as an author, I had run away to London where they would pay me more money. And it wasn't quite like that, but after that I made sure that Canongate... Well, my next novel was... A small one, but in fact, I made sure that because the difficulty was that as Neville Moyer pointed out that Canongate couldn't always pay money owed for royalties, and therefore I did almost of every second book published in London because I got the money steadily and I needed it, to say we, I'm glad to say that one of the books, the book of the illustrated book of
Life and Pieces.
Pardon? Yes, the picture book, Canongate did bring it out, and successfully, and it's also going to be publishing starting next year. My version of Dante's Divine Comedy, which I was really rather surprised by because at the time of writing it. I didn't think any publisher would be very interested in it, simply because a new version of Dante, or translation in English, comes out about every year or every second year.
We've got to wind this up, Alistair, because we could be
fine.
Here. And what we're going to do now, we're going to get straight on. We're going to have Rory come and talk about the classics, I'm afraid.
Ah, right, yes,
we're
sorry.
We're going to run out of time otherwise for everyone.
That's fine. What I will do is read...
I don't know if we've got time, Alistair. We're going to have to leave.
Yes, that's right. This is a poem with which I ended Lanark. I started making maps when I was small, showing place, resources, where the enemy and where lovely. I did not know time adds to land. Events drift continually down, effacing landmarks, raising the level like snow. I have grown up. My maps are out of date. The land lies over me now. I cannot move. It is time to go.
Thank you so much. It is such a treat to have you on the stage, and brilliant. Next up is the amazing Rory Watson, who I first met through Stephanie, ran the classic series, was the series editor, who's going to talk a little bit about the brilliant series he drove with Stephanie and a brilliant editorial team. Rory Watson.
That's called a difficult act to follow, I think. Stephanie was passionate, driven, committed. She trusted us. She took chances. She was a deeply intuitive kind of publisher. Not many of them left anymore. And kind of dangerous. I remember we were, the editorial bunch that did the classics were sitting in the office one day, and boxes and boxes of newly published books on the Canongate main title series were sitting around us, just produced, just newly boxed up. And Stephanie decided, after all, she didn't really like the cover. She sent them all back to be rebound. I mean, you just don't do that. That's just astonishing. Bless her. I had the pleasure of dealing with one of the later projects in the Canny Classics was the Pocket Classics. And we got Alistair Gray to write a pocket history of Scottish literature, a tiny little booklet. Eloquent, astute, extremely good. I had the pleasure of receiving it in installments, rather late installments, it has to be said, written with a big black pen on paper. I photocopied them, I confess. I photocopied these holograph manuscripts from Alistair Gray and kept them for myself. Well, it was about 1986 or so that Walter Cairns and the Scottish Arts Council of Blessed Memory proposed a reprint series for Scottish literary works. Stephanie and John Pick got together to put a bid in and won. I believe Penguin were in the running too. But this was public money, and the Scottish Arts Council required the books, required the edition to be overseen by an editorial board who weren't employees of Canongate. And I'd just written a big literary history of Scotland, and I think that's why they asked me to become the series editor for this project. John Pick was on the team with us, and Tom Crawford. Latterly, the editorial group was Dorothy McMillan and Cairns Craig and John and me. The remit was that these would be well-designed books, inexpensively produced for the common reader at a reasonable price. The designer was George Mackey of Edinburgh University Press fame, and you may remember the first edition of Eddie Morgan's Second Life, that beautiful book that was George Mackey's work. He designed the slanted ribbon across the front cover of the early Canongates. We wanted it to be, I liked the potted bios that Penguin books used to have on the inside page, so we did that. We thought that would be a good idea, and they're still popping up in different forms ever since. Our idea was that these would be the best versions of regular books, but we wanted them to be Canongate classics, not just Scottish classics. The idea of that was to give us a little bit more freedom in how we approached the remit. The best versions, Tom Crawford edited Lewis Grassy Gibbon's Scots Quair. He tidied up errors in the text. He reintroduced the maps. He added an extended glossary on these. That is the best edition of the Scots Quare that you can buy. We got Andrew Todd. I asked Andrew Todd, who is a fan of Elizabeth Grant, Memoirs of a Highland Lady. I got Andrew Todd to edit that book. It had been badly treated in the past. He went back to the manuscripts and produced a wonderful edition of Memoirs of a Highland Lady. We asked the academic Rod Lyle to do a fully annotated edition of the Satire of the Three Estates. We got Archie Duncan to produce a similarly scholarly edition of The Bruce. I could go on and on. I have somewhere here, I think. I have a piece of paper. No, I have a piece of paper with the first 100 titles on it. But we wanted to do more. We got a young academic at Stirling, Jackie Tassioulas, to produce an anthology of the Makars. We got the scholar, folklife scholar Emily Lyle, to do an edition of the ballads. Now these were books that we were composing. These were not reprint series of already existing books. Alexander Brodie did the Enlightenment Reader. This was not cheap, but at every turn, Stephanie stood behind us and trusted us and supported the entire project. We wanted to rethink the canon. The first four titles, we had Willemure's Imagined Corners, a book far too long out of print, an author far too long forgotten. And in later editions, we got Kirsty Allen to do Imagined Selves, which is an anthology of Willemure's other writing, fictional and essays. We did Nan Shepherd's Quarry Wood. That was one of the first four titles. I introduced and edited that and ended up doing the same for all her works. That's actually one of the things I'm proudest of having done in my entire career. It was extraordinary to bring Nan Shepherd back into the light, back into publication, and back into what is quite clearly very high critical esteem. So that's really the essence of what I have to say, that Stephanie backed us, trusted us, let us get on with it, and the Canongate series in that sense has been carried on by the friends I made in Canada at that time, Judy and Neville Moyer and Hugh Andrew, who are continuing that kind of tradition in their own publications, and of course a lot of the early classics are now part of the regular Canongate list.
Two more speakers. First up, Tom Powell, very briefly, but not. He's got some brilliant things to say and one beautiful thing to read. Thank you.
Two of the books that Stephanie told me she was proudest to have published were Alistair Reid's selected poems and translations, Weathering, and his book of essays, Whereabouts. Alistair first met Stephanie and Gus on their honeymoon in Morocco. You can imagine what a striking couple they made, he said. His eyes widened when he told me how beautiful Stephanie was. She remained beautiful. There is a poem in Weathering called Scotland with which Alistair became so fed up that he set fire to it after a reading at St Andrews, thus marking its end of his involvement with it. And there is a poem to which we all, at some point, aspire, Weathering. Stephanie and Alistair remained great friends all their lives, and I see them both in this poem. Weathering, as you can see, is something both of them did well. Weathering. I am old enough now for a tree once planted knee-high to have grown to be 20 times me, and to have seen babies marry and heroes grow deaf. But that's enough meaning of life. It's living through time we ought to be connoisseurs of. From wearing a face all this time, I am made aware of the maps faces are, of the inside wear and tear. I take to faces that have come far. In my father's carved face, the bright eye he sometimes would look out of, seeing a long way through all the tree rings of his history. I am awed by how things weather. An oak mantle in the house in Spain, fingered to a sheen. The marks of hands lent into the lintel. The tokens in the drawer I sometimes touch. A crystal lived in on a trip. The watch my father's wrist wore to a thin gold sandwich. It is an equilibrium which breasts the cresting seasons, but still stays calm and keeps warm. It deserves a good name. Weathering, patina, gloss and whorl. The trunk of the almond tree, gnarled but still fruitful. Weathering is what I would like to do well.
Okay, we've got one last treat for you, which is another writer, is going to be a reading by a writer who Canongate published with much joy and pleasure and success and was a very dear friend of Stephanie's. It's the great Sandy McCall Smith. Thank you.
This is a very brief poem, and I've got a very, very brief anecdote. People talked about payment. Ian Burgum, who was a friend of mine who used to work in Canongate, said that one week there was absolutely no money in the till, and Stephanie came up to him and said, Ian, I'm sorry, I can't pay you at the end of this week, but may I pay you in sandwiches? And I think she did. I've written a poem in Stephanie's memory. It's very brief, and I'd like to read it to you this evening. It's called A Maker of Beautiful Books, in memory of Stephanie Wolfe Murray, publisher. A maker of beautiful books knows exactly what it is that makes paper, card, printer's ink into the raw words of the writer, into that lovely object we call a book, understands the subtle work of fonts, of leading, of bindings, that makes a book something we wish to hold to ourselves, to keep and cherish, to read at times when the soul is in need of solace, of insight, and art that can transform the quotidian into the transcendent. A maker of beautiful books understands that text should whisper to us its message like a confiding friend, not in the trumpet tones of the strident, the polemical, but gently, tactfully, in private places of exchange where the loud and the angry have no wish to linger. A maker of beautiful books brings people together in civil and gracious converse, helps the puzzled and confused to understand what it is that puzzles or confuses them, puts an end to that ignorance on which all evil parasitically thrives, shows the weak the way to strength, brings freedom to the most remote corners, reminds us of love and its manifold works. A maker of beautiful books lies in a border's field, with all the hills as watchmen. But the books she made live on, resolute upon their shelves, in 100 far-flung places, their maker's advocates, her legacy, her sure and beautiful touch upon our troubled world, less troubled for her presence, surer for her example of the possibilities of truth and beauty. Thank you.
What a beautiful way to end this. Thank you very much for that, Sandy. She was indeed a beautiful maker of books. Before anyone else leaves this room, because you're all going to have to leave pretty quickly, the four authors, Alistair and Tom and Mary and Sandy, are going to be doing a signing next door. So if you could just let them get out first. You're also going to be given... Jim Hutchinson, who's our art director for many years, designed, and Rupert Wolfe Murray did. It's got a lot. You'll be given it as you walk out. So take a copy of this as a little gift. And I just want to say thank you all for coming to this event. I think Stephanie would have been proud, not least because it's running late, which she would be very happy about. And She wouldn't have cared either, which also I don't. But I do. I want to say a big thank you to the Edinburgh Festival for letting us put this on. Thank you very much. I don't know if they're there, but you were very good to allow us to put this event to celebrate one of the great women I've certainly ever met in my life, and a woman who changed my life and almost everyone's life who ever met her. So thank you all for coming.
Just our faith, and how will this all play? No sign out of mind. Who we gonna blame? Oh no, it's just the cry of shame. It's such a cry of shame. It's such a cry of shame. I heard some words from a friend on the phone, didn't sound so good. The doctor gave him 2 weeks to live, I'd give him one if I could.
to say that new life makes losing life easier to understand. Words are kind, they help ease the mind on this mind. Gotta go, we'll keep a piece of your soul. Goes out, one comes in.